everybody, and welcome again to another episode of Talking to Change, a motivational interviewing podcast. My name is Glenn Hines, and I'm based in Derry, Northern Ireland, and I'm joined, as always, by my good friend and colleague, Sebastian Kaplan. Hi, Seb.
Hey, Glenn. How are you today?
Well, considering the circumstances we find ourselves in, this is our first recording in the midst of this global pandemic, COVID-19 coronavirus, and I suppose it shows us the beauty of Zoom and other technical links that we can socially distance and still stay in contact. That apart from talking to you today, that I've seen my mum, my dad, and my wife and daughter, and that's been my only social contact. But very, very strange times, and I imagine for you as well in the States.
Yeah, I'm based in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I imagine even as we're setting the context here, it's helpful to say it's March 22nd. One of the things that's pretty apparent, I think, to a lot of people is that from one day to the next, the situation changes quite drastically. So yeah. For those listening to this, they might literally be wondering, wait, was that on Sunday or was that on Monday? Because again, situations, depending on where you are, they change quite considerably. Yeah, here in the States, there's the larger cities, New York, LA, San Francisco, they're going through progressively more significant measures to keep people indoors and make sure that they're distancing. And here in North Carolina, we seem to be a few days behind the actions of these larger communities. So, you know, whether it was school closures or restaurant closures, so I am anticipating we are going to fall in line here in the next few days. But it's, I guess one thing, yeah, you mentioned in some ways with our social distancing, we've found other ways to connect and to connect in really global ways. I don't know that you and I have talked as much, even as we've been doing this podcast for a year and a half.
Sure.
We probably talked more than we've ever had.
Sure.
So it is a response, maybe just speaks to the natural human tendency and need for contact, whether it's in person or over a screen.
Yeah. And given the circumstances, that's what has drawn us to invite our guest today, Jane Groves, to talk to us. Jane has a lot of experience in public health, and we felt it was important to take the opportunity to reach out and speak to someone with an understanding of the bigger picture and the mechanics of that, what's going on. So we're really looking forward to talking to Jane today and getting her insights. But before they do that, Seb, will you maybe just remind people of the social media links?
Absolutely. So on Facebook, our page is Talking to Change. On Twitter, it is @ChangeTalking. On Instagram, it is Talking to Change Podcast. And email, you can reach us at podcast@glennhines.com. And as always, we welcome feedback, we welcome reviews, we welcome questions, and any sort of interaction with our audience is greatly appreciated and welcome. And we do have one question that we'll get to today that came to us via Twitter.
Yes.
From Maddie Nicholson.
That's
so
right.
we'll get to that.
Fantastic. So onward and upward. Hello, Jane. You're very welcome to Talking to Change. It's a joy to have you here with us, and we really appreciate you giving up your time here on a Sunday afternoon. So can maybe just introduce yourself, tell us who you are, what you've done, and part of your journey into motivational interviewing.
Okay, Glenn, thanks very much for having me. It's great to be here. And it's great to be doing things like this at a time like this, in fact. I think that's what's wonderful. So I'm Jane Groves. I'm a retired public health specialist, health improvement specialist. I've been working in the field of public health and health improvement for 35 or so years. And since retirement from my employment, I've simply been freelance, and that's mainly a freelance trainer, and motivational interviewing takes up a big part of that role.
And you are based in Scotland, is that correct?
Yeah, I should have said, I'm based in Scotland. So so my career has been in the health service, the NHS, in both Scotland and in England. As I say, working in health improvement stroke public health. So it's always been about working across agencies to plan strategically for health, to plan strategically for well-being as well. And in recent years, in Scotland in particular, to look at the reduction of health inequalities as a huge element of that. So it's been that kind of big picture. But clearly, a lot of what that consists of is also about behaviour, as well as the big structural stuff. There's a lot which is about behaviour and the lifestyles that people have and so on. And I guess that's how I came into motivational interviewing, looking at how we can support people to make changes in their lives in all kinds of different contexts. But, you know, things like heart disease or diabetes or whatever. And certainly I came into motivational interviewing, well, at least 20 years ago. It must be a lot longer than that now. And it seemed obvious as a very, very good way of working with individuals. So for me, it's very, very important. And it's something I'm now a member of Mint and have been for a long time. It's something I carry on all the time as a trainer, but also as a trainer of trainers. But I have always seen it as only one part, the work with the individuals, as only one part of a whole spectrum of different kinds of initiatives that are required to support people's health.
So there's big picture oversight of of circumstances and looking at, I suppose, jigsaw pieces or the pieces of the jigsaw that can bring about the changes that are desired. You mentioned there the structural changes, and I guess what you're talking about there is just the way organizations are put together and how they communicate and the services that they provide. And then further down the chain, then it's about the individual's contact with the community and the way they practice. And I suppose, there's, as you say, there's this crossover. And I suppose one of the things we can be really interested in today is where that, is there a thread that runs its way through from the macro right down to the micro that you've noticed over the years and what that might have been. But given that we're in this situation at the minute, Jane, I wonder what your own views or your own thoughts are about the situation that all of us find ourselves in. Everybody listening to this podcast anywhere in the world on March 23rd or in the days after it will know what we're talking about in relation to COVID-19. And I'm just wondering, from a public health perspective, what are your thoughts and what are the lessons and maybe one of the ways of what can we be doing differently in the way we interact with each other?
I mean, it's really, really interesting because it's... I mean, it's fascinating what's going on. It's also incredibly scary, but it's fascinating what's going on because very quickly it's become obvious that although some of the measures needed to tackle this are absolutely behavioural and individuals have to change their behaviour in particular ways in order to slow down the spread of this illness because of cross-contamination. And so very many of the kind of lessons about contamination and cross-contamination that we had many years ago, we've kind of lost and we've got to re-remember those things. So a lot of it, there's absolutely no doubt, huge, huge amount, is about individual behaviour and making that possible. And it's obvious that if we want to improve the health of our populations, and I don't just mean our country populations, but our world populations, then, you know, the individual's role within that is crucial to actually slowing down that spread. However, it's also thrown up very quickly, just in a couple of weeks, again, the limitations of that in terms of some people's capability of changing their behavior because of the circumstances in which they find themselves. So we're asking everyone to wash their hands, to keep their distance and so on. And the people who are going to find that the hardest are the people who are at the bottom of the pile, one way or another. The people who have no jobs, the people who have no homes, who have no facilities, who have no money. And very quickly, it's been obvious that governments have recognized this and are starting to put into play measures, therefore, to support people so that we're not left, we hope, we're not left so much with a huge sort of underclass of people suffering. And the reason for that isn't just to stop people suffering, although one hopes that some of it's around that. But pragmatically, if you don't do that, then you're going to carry on spreading this illness. So some of the remarkable things that our government in the UK have put in play recently, for given that they're a Conservative government, are things like if people's jobs are at risk, then the government will pay 80% of their wages so that they get retained on the books. People are not able to be evicted from their rental properties, their houses. Sick pay will come into play immediately. And of course, there is always sick pay here, and there are many countries where that doesn't happen. I think I heard today that hotels are going to be used to house homeless people. So there are very many measures to do with, you know, which actually are to do with supporting basic good social welfare, which we've let slip in the UK in recent years. They haven't let slip nearly so much in quite a few European countries, but the UK has not been good, and America is certainly not good. But it's so obvious now that these things are utterly necessary if we want to improve the health of the population by reducing the spread of this illness. So it's fascinating for me. I've spent my life in public health looking at the social determinants of health, the upstream things, and trying to influence those. And then suddenly we have this, and all of a sudden, some of these major changes are happening.
Yeah. There's so many places to dive deeper there, from the individual type of interventions and behavior change requests, challenges, mandates perhaps, to broad-based political interventions. And maybe before I ask you or reflect on any one of those in particular, I was thinking about this episode in general, not just in the climate that we're in with COVID-19, but in the context of our podcast thus far. Our guests have been perhaps more focused on particular applications of MI or particular populations that then eventually we could imagine trickle down to a provider of some kind having a conversation with an individual client or a group of people, or maybe ways of how to think about MI in business settings or in organizational settings. And so with you on our podcast, we have the lens open the farthest than we have thus far. And so people might be thinking, I know I was thinking, like, so what do you do? Like, what is your role? What was your work like, or what is it still like from a public health standpoint? And does it truly span the individual all the way to that large level, entire country-based kind of focus? And maybe that's the field of public health, but your particular work has been in a more narrowed field within that range, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, my jobs in public health have covered most of that range at various times. And I think you have to start with that very large picture and understanding of that very large picture in order to then understand in more detail how we work with individuals and what the implications for MI. I mean, I guess there's two things really, two truths. One is that in order to understand the health of individuals, you must understand the health of populations and what creates population health, what creates changes there. And there are two elements of that. We know that the health of individuals is affected acutely by social and economic determinants, as well to an extent by their own behaviour. And if we want to intervene there to both change the health of populations and the individuals within it, we have to intervene at all these different levels, including getting it right, working with individuals, but also working at the higher levels. And of course, these are usually at those levels, these are decisions, these are policy decisions, which are greatly influenced by the government at the time. So to that extent, they're political decisions a lot of the time, but basically they're policy decisions. And I think the other part of the big picture is understanding, and we know an awful lot more now, about inequalities in health in our society. So we know that a country may be a very wealthy country, but if there's a huge gap between those at the top of that pile and those at the bottom of that pile, then the country as a whole will suffer worse health. And so you really only need to look at a comparison of countries like America, UK, with Japan, Sweden, Norway. And I have to say the UK, well, particularly America, and to an extent the UK, are much more unequal than Japan, Sweden, Norway. And you see this reflected in patterns of illness, rates of addiction, obesity, all kinds of things. So what's causing it isn't how wealthy that country is, but it's the gap between the rich and the poor in that country. And again, there's been an awful lot of very interesting research that shows that this is not just because some people don't have money and others do. It's because some of it is down to different people in different groups living different lifestyles. But we know it's actually probably only about 20% is to do with whether we smoke or drink or whatever. The rest of that gap can be explained by things like people feeling that they don't have any control in their lives, people feeling they don't have power, people feeling they're not valued, people feeling that they don't have any influence or stake in their society. So there's very interesting research that looks at that. So in other words, we can learn an awful lot about when we look at patterns of health and illness, about what affects the health and the illness of the individual. And the other thing we mustn't forget is also knowing that well-being and a person's sense of wellness, which arises from competence, a sense of competence, a sense of power, a sense of being able to do something, a sense of being valued. This is also what sustains health, sustains well-being. So these are lessons we can't let go in terms of working with individuals at the best of times, and MI needs to take account of that. And the same is the case now, as people are all struggling with the behaviour changes that they have to make around this virus. So for some of us, that's easier. For others, it's not so easy. And certainly we have to help people structurally and, you know, socially in every way we can, that it's possible for them to make changes. And also we have the big challenge of clearly of, you know, working with the whole population for them to realize that the changes they make as individuals aren't so much about them protecting themselves as individuals, but it protecting the whole population. So it's a bit like vaccination. You know we need to vaccinate in order that we protect the whole population, not just us. And the more individual focus we tend to have, the more that's been lost. And you can see that obviously in changing rates of vaccinations in recent time.
And as Seb mentioned, there's just so much that you're offering us here, Jane, which is fantastic. And, you know, just the idea of the autonomy, the influence, the value, sense of value, the sense of stake in the environment. And what springs to my mind there is, you know, you're speaking from the spirit of Motivational Interviewing, the very thing that we start our intervention with is that endeavor to connect, to engage an individual as a meaningful person and to value who they are and to value the journey that they've taken to get to where they have arrived at. While they may be presenting with problems, that there's a bigger picture of the individual. And it sounds like it's almost like we can look at an individual and make sense of it from their big picture and then just translate that into a society. And the same thing's true there, that there are individuals within society who are doing very well. There's parts of ourselves doing very well, but there's probably parts of everybody who's struggling as well. And how well do we bring those two parts of ourselves together? Because the closer we are as an individual within ourselves, the closer we are as individuals to each other in our community, what you're saying is that the happier and the more content and healthier we become.
Absolutely. Part of this is recognizing that our health isn't just about what we do. It's about what happens to us. So that, you know, any MI practitioner has to take that into account all the time. It's also about the way that we are connected with other people and are sustained by other people and are part of the communities in which we live. But as you said also, Glenn, you know, a lot of the kind of lessons from the bigger health inequality stuff are directly relevant to MI, because clearly MI starts from a focus of working with someone so that they have power, they develop competence, that they feel valued, and that they make decisions. So in that sense, the basic spirit of MI is very consistent with this kind of approach, and that's fantastic. I guess I would always hope that MI practitioners could also go one step further and think about the wider things in people's lives that may also help them to be healthier. And, you know, that might even mean helping them become more active in their community, helping them be activists for things which support the health of communities. All those kinds of things are almost just as useful as the much more sort of internal type of things. And I think that's still relevant now, because, you know, the dilemma of an MI practitioner is multifold at the moment. It's certainly about how do you have good conversations with people about changes, behavioural changes that they may really not understand the need for or how to do it or the urgency of it. But it's also about helping those individuals gain a sense of meaning in their life, meaning and purpose in their life at a time when everything can seem to be out of control. And we know from Antonovsky's work on what he calls salutogenesis, what sustains and supports well-being, that meaning and purpose is one of the key points there, and connectedness and competence. So the MI practitioner can help not just with the individual's own exploration of themselves, they can help the individual gain meaning and purpose through helping them think about how they can be helping others at this kind of time, how they can be connecting with others at this time, this kind of time, and so on. So the range of kind of behavioral choices we're looking at are big, as well as helping people sustain their mental well-being at a time of great stress. And clearly that's really, really, really crucial as well. So there's a kind of really complex role for MI practitioners, the information stuff, the kind of what can we do stuff, and there's the how can we look after ourselves stuff.
Seems like you're proposing one of the ways in which people, maybe it's more sort of foundational for people to be in touch with that might propel them to change, is connecting any sort of intervention on where does an individual find meaning and purpose in their life.
I think that's one thing, yeah.
Yeah. And so that can be done in individual conversations, client, practitioner, whatever the field might be. but to kind of widen that lens again and zooming out in a more broader based way, what are some examples of communication strategies or public health initiatives that you've had experience with that have successfully tapped, or maybe unsuccessfully, I suppose, but tapped into the meaning and purpose that would lead to behavior change in a more population-based way, or even just thinking about COVID-19 now and what you noted in the efforts to tap into that to lead to population change currently?
I mean, certainly at the moment, you know, practically at the moment, you see a sudden upsurge of community initiatives. And, you know, people are going through a kind of probably fairly predictable story as individuals. This has been just a few weeks. So there's fear, there's shock, there's how do I protect myself? How do I protect my family? And then people start to move to needing to feel that they have control over something in their lives at the moment. And part of that is helping others. So there's an awful lot of community groups setting up, and thank goodness we have social, we have, you know, tools like Zoom and so on, so that people can connect. But just at a local level, an enormous amount of community development, really. I've spent my whole career trying to support community development, and suddenly it's happening in quite a big way, and it's happening for really good practical reasons, real good practical needs. But for the individuals involved, it also fulfills an enormous need. And that's the need to be able to do something at a time when they feel their lives are out of control. So that's really interesting. And I'm sure there's masses of things going on that, you know, I'm unaware of. I mean, I can certainly give examples of, you know, pre-COVID-19 of sort of the layering of different kinds of interventions, if you're interested.
A brief example might be great, just to see, just to be able to see how this kind of plays out practically.
Yeah, I mean, my colleague Fiona Clark and I ran a workshop in the Social Determinants of Health in the Tallinn Mint Forum last year, and we were telling the same story really prior to COVID-19, that really it's essential that we should be looking at this bigger picture. So one of the kind of examples I was looking at was very simple one, really, breastfeeding. So we know it's better for women to breastfeed. So there's clearly an educational role there in terms of helping people have information about why this is important and how they would do it, but also what it means for them and what it means for their relationships, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all the kind of individual behavior stuff. But behind that, we know that also that people will not make these changes in behavior unless they have got a sense of self-efficacy. They feel it's possible to do this. They feel competent. And that, you know, MI tells us that as well. So we need perhaps to spend an awful lot longer looking at self-efficacy than we do at the messages. So that's one thing. And a lot of work has gone into doing that. But other interventions in our breastfeeding strategies, for instance, were, you know, at higher levels. So we would have peer support groups. So we would have breastfeeding peer support groups, training up people very often from quite disadvantaged groups or disadvantaged communities to be breastfeeding peer supporters of each other. Incredibly important. And I always remember seeing a young girl, she was only 17, talking about this in a public forum. She was a vulnerable mother. And she had been supported to breastfeed her child, but also to get involved actively at a local level, supporting other women and also fighting for access to breastfeeding facilities in her locality. And there she was, speaking out with all these health professionals. So clearly the benefits to her were enormous in terms of her self-esteem, her feeling that she was being valued, that she had something to say. And then, of course, there are also interventions around breastfeeding to do with what goes on in the hospitals and regulations and how things happen and standards to do with supporting breastfeeding. So that's just kind of one example of something that can seem quite simple. Tell people to breastfeed more. reaching out and linking in with all kinds of things, and how the individual and the heart of that can be, you know, their health can move, and their sense of themselves can become so much more strong if they're not just helped to change that behavior, but to think about the sort of wider community picture of mm-hmm. that and in where they're living. So that's kind of one example. Does that make sense?
Again, it sounds like you're inviting us to reflect on the health of an individual and the health of the community are directly correlated, directly connected. And a healthy yeah. community is based on healthy individuals who have that sense of purpose, connection, autonomy, and yeah. that sense of efficacy. And in some ways, it strikes me that it's almost like we're experiencing a social shock across the world right now. And it's forcing us to think differently. We don't have a lot of choices within this restriction. I read a lovely thing the other day. It's like Mother Nature has sent us to a room to think about things. And if that's the case, from what you're saying, is what she's inviting us to think about is each other as well as ourselves. It's about what can I be doing for myself and for others, recognizing I have to keep myself safe and I have to, while keeping other people safe, but how can I support the community in this time of lockdown? How can I support other people? And it's how to be creative and imaginative. And clearly you're saying that you're seeing lots of examples, as I am as well, of people responding in very, very creative ways, very, very mm-hmm. quickly to look very at, quickly. You know, how do we do this differently?
Mm-hmm.
And the energy behind that is very positive, I feel.
It's wonderful. And it's also about access to resources, Glenn.
Right.
We're each of us as an individual just now. We should all be thinking about our own well-being plan. What do we do to maintain our physical health and our mental health? And one of the things within that we know helps is helping someone else. It's really, really helpful. Making community connections and so on, but also enabling access to resources.
So are there things that we have that we could make available to other people? And it struck me earlier on again, what you said is the most isolated people in our society need us to look after them for our own health.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing about this, especially at a time when we've all locked down our countries, is that this applies a world level as well. Really doesn't do any good to not provide medicines and protective equipment and so on to Iran, for instance. You know, so the more populations in our world who are vulnerable, the more vulnerable our world is, just the same as between individuals and our country populations. Again, we have to remember that tremendously. So many of the same messages are relevant to climate change and tackling that as well. We have to think of how we improve life for each of us as an individual by looking at improving our planet, our world as a whole.
During our conversation, I was reminded of something I saw also recently on Twitter or something, and it was a message from Nike. We're not endorsing Nike as a company or anything, but it's this thing that's gone around now, which says in this really stark black lettering, bold black lettering on a white background, if you ever dreamed of playing for millions around the world, now is your chance. Play inside, play for the world. Which, you know, Nike's very good at marketing, of course, but it does seem like in some ways it was a public health message that also tried to tap into for those athletically inclined young people, perhaps. I imagine that's who they're specifically targeting. It's speaking to something that maybe has something that young people have dreamt of, or something that even in the world of fantasy has given them some meaning or purpose, and how that might translate to individual behavior in a rather clever, creative way.
That's interesting. Yeah, quite nice.
Glenna, given the time, should we get to Maddie's question and sure. see what we can do with that? And we have
So I tweeted out yesterday just an opportunity for people to offer questions to Jane, and we had a response from Maddie Nicholson. And the question was, currently much advice has been given to the general public. How would you encourage healthcare professionals to advise people using motivational interviewing?
I mean, I think I said at the beginning of this, Glenn, there are many better MI practitioners out there who could answer this better than I can. But I think it's, you know, we've already talked about some of the answers to that just now. There's the very simple issue of transmission of information, clearly, and, you know, the tactics like illicit, provide illicit and so on, which can help around that kind of thing. But we've also got clues to what will prevent, you know, information. We know all too well that information on its own does not make people change behavior. They need to feel powerful. They need to feel competent. And the role of the MI practitioner in supporting that through acceptance, through compassion, through supporting their self-efficacy is really, really crucial as well. So we just have to be quite careful, you know, look to the lessons from the past. We all do many things all the time that we know, that, strictly speaking, we shouldn't be doing for our health. And that's because the simple equation gives someone information and it will change their attitudes and therefore change their behavior is flawed. It's wrong. It doesn't work. Decisions about changing behavior are far more complicated than that. So as MI practitioners, we've got to look beyond just the simple messages and the kind of compassionate conversations we might have to helping people think about, well, how can you help people feel safe just now? But also, how can you help those individuals change norms of behavior in their communities? A bit like that example that you just talked about Nike. So messages have to be kind of accepted at a normative level as well as at an individual level. So again, it's partly looking at slightly at the limitations of work with one individual. You know, your MI practitioners really need to be working as part of a kind of whole approach, which also looks at messages across the community, how those are accepted and how those are transmitted and what happens, as well as how can we best really support those individuals.
It's your reminder that providing information is not all that helpful and successful strategy to lead a behavior change is probably a really helpful reminder, because the healthcare system or the various systems across the world are probably under immense pressure to do things quickly and efficiently. That's often what I think we'd all agree, or at least maybe one of the things that lead people to rely solely on information giving is, I don't have enough time, I have people backed up, there's so much pressure on healthcare providers now that I imagine many of them would launch quite quickly into the litany of reasons and instructions, do this, don't do that. So it's a helpful reminder that even though we're in a global pandemic and there's all this heightened stress and social distancing and all that, the basics of behavior change are likely the same. And using, using a communication strategy like illicit, provide illicit, where we might ask first, what do you know about ways to keep yourself and your community safe amidst COVID-19? Like that, instead of launching into a lecture.
Absolutely, yeah. It's back down to power and control as always. So that's what illicit, provide illicit does. It puts the power in the hands of the individual, the autonomy in the hands of the individual to talk, and then you've got the opportunity to provide. I mean, the messages here are complicated. That's the trouble as well. This understanding of the need for individual change in order to affect populations isn't an easy one. That's quite hard. But absolutely, we must never forget that, you know, the complexities of behavioral science really have to be remembered at this time as well. But I think one of the lessons we've had in the past around a sort of a good way of helping people own information and own messages is to make sure that they are involved in creating it. You know, so going back to your breastfeeding thing, great, you know, great way of transmitting information there would be to work with young mothers for them to produce the information. The more that people participate, in other words, the more they have power in interventions, the more it's going to have meaning and it will stick with them because it's theirs then. And that's why community development and community approaches are so crucial here as well. So although it's very fast moving times, and these might seem quite sort of subtle ways of working when all we want to do is just tell people what to do, we of course we've got to tell people what to do, and we have to have consistent media messages, really clear, consistent media messages. But at the same time, I think we also have to look at sort of underlying ways of actually helping people own those messages at an individual and a local level. It's not just all top down. Actually, what was quite an interesting, I'm remembering a story I heard when I first went into health improvement a long time ago. And it was about the rollout of TB vaccines in the 1950s in Edinburgh in Scotland. And again, you know, messages that people, you know, we can tell people to do this, but it's quite hard for them to understand it. And what they did, in certainly in Edinburgh, was that they created sort of local activist groups in localities that went round sort of spreading those messages and encouraging people to come for vaccination and to bring their children for vaccination. So the more that you can kind of encourage that community empowerment and community involvement, the easier it will be for messages to spread around. So again, you know, it's just interesting when thinking about an individual MI practitioner, they're only one part, they're a crucial part, but they're only one part of a much bigger picture. And they maybe need to be thinking about working alongside other kinds of workers at the moment. And I would say community development workers in particular.
What you're describing is consistent with what's arising now here in Northern Ireland, the idea of co-production, the idea of, the idea of, you know, how do we get the families that we work with to work with us to come up with an idea or a shared way forward. And that is a shift in culture. And I think one of the challenges for us as helping practitioners is to recognize that, you know, for it's us that's going to have to give away some of the power for other people to feel empowered. And what's the price that we're going to pay to create this new world that that we are the haves, and we're going to be giving this, some of the haves to the have-nots, and part of what we're given is our power and an opportunity to choose. And again, that's consistent with the spirit of motivational interviewing, that that's the invitation. Like, what if you trusted this other human being to be the best guide for their own journey, and that you come alongside and offer bits of information, bits of expertise that's consistent with what they need rather than what you think they need?
Absolutely. It's co-production. I mean, all my career in public health and health improvement, community development, community empowerment has been at the core of it, really trying to support that. And this kind of support for that has ebbed and flowed as time has gone on, usually in the context of a different political governance, to be honest. And that's a problem. But it's one of the key weigh-ins. And the other, I think, as well, is recognizing, and this works not just as an individual level, but at communities, recognizing the assets that are there. So recognizing the strengths within individuals, within communities, rather than the problems. And that's clearly part of MI, but it also needs to apply at a societal or community level as well. And I know these are long-term things, but I do think that some of this has got great lessons for how we handle this, you know, immediate crisis as well. So in terms of, if you were to look at the kind of pattern or array of interventions that are necessary to try and slow down the spread of this virus, you would have all these layers. There's a very nice model called the Rainbow Model of Health by people called Whitehead and Dahlgren. Very simple, used it for years. And it kind of puts the individual in the middle, and obviously the genetics as well, and the individual lifestyle. And then their you know, them and their community and their family, and then, you know, their employment, et cetera, et cetera. And then the sort of bigger picture. And you, I think this crisis is a classic example of how you need interventions at all those levels in order for things to work.
And I'm thinking at each of those levels, there are probably practitioners that link up and connect with individuals at each of those levels. And like you can imagine a practitioner just staying at their level, at that particular level within that model. Or, and I'm wondering if you can imagine, or if you've had experience training, say, physicians or nurses that might work very much at an individual level, and invite them to explore how an individual client or patient might make changes at other levels, right? So,
oh yes,
right. So maybe, and maybe there's, in thinking about ambivalence, let's say there may be ambivalence about breastfeeding, about for themselves, whether that's the right thing for them to do and for whatever reason. But then would there also be a conversation about their ambivalence of thinking about breastfeeding beyond themselves and into that more so community-based level, if that makes sense?
You mean from the practitioner's perspective?
Right, like, yeah. I mean, you worked with practitioners that work across levels, I suppose.
Well, I mean, it's very interesting. At a strategic level in Scotland for quite a number of years now, threaded through all health policy, whatever it is the need to address reducing the health inequalities gap. So we're really meant to look at all our interventions with a benchmarking of, are we actually increasing the health inequalities gap by what we do, or are we just reducing it? And that applies to everything, you know, from hospitals onwards. So yes, we have worked for years with practitioners, individual practitioners, to look at that wider stuff. And there's been a lot of very interesting work going on. And I'm thinking now of work with GPs, general practitioners, around health inequalities. That's been, for a long time, there has been a very interesting group in Glasgow, for instance, where there's a severe health inequalities and deprivation in some area. And the GPs there became aware that, you know, people were coming in with heart disease and diabetes and this, that, and the next thing. And actually, they were going home to circumstances where it was almost impossible for them to deal with some of the issues around their illnesses. So the GPs formed a group called GPs at the Deep End, and they started to very much look at that wider role. What does that mean? Does it mean an awful lot of it's about advocating for people? It's about directing people. One of the things I should have mentioned when talking about breastfeeding is we train up all midwives to be able to identify if someone is likely to be suffering from income deprivation or abuse, and so that they can help direct them to someone else that can help them. So they're all trained to help people access the benefits to which they're all entitled, all of these things. So yeah, practitioners who normally simply work with individuals on their health or their well-being absolutely can take a role in directing people to other help and ensuring that they ask the right questions. And they can also work in partnership with other people whose responsibility it is to do the more upstream stuff. We're not suggesting all GPs go and, you know, I don't know, set up employment centres or something. But it has become obvious to many that there needs to be more work going on upstream in order for fewer people to come into their surgeries and unable to help themselves.
An ongoing shift in culture away from specialisms, moving back towards more of a generic approach, that each practitioner has responsibilities for lots of issues for an individual rather than, and the breastfeeding person, that they go to the social worker for housing, that I take responsibility for this person's housing situation and take it into account when I'm trying to help them change their breastfeeding behaviour, rather than just going, okay, I'm just going to talk about breastfeeding, and I'll refer you on to a social worker without taking cognizance of your experience and my relationship with you. And again, I wonder what thoughts you have about how we can be helping each other and ourselves on that journey, because it feels like we're on that journey. And I know from the work, I used to work in addictions, and certainly here in Northern Ireland, I always looked across the water to Scotland, and Scotland seemed to be about 15 years ahead, 10, 15 years ahead of what we were doing. There's a lot of fantastic social development going on in Scotland, and have been, you know, for the last 30, 40 years in my awareness. And I'm wondering what it is that you have learned in that place, that for us that are coming on your coattails, what you can be teaching us about how to help practitioners shift that cultural relationship to come out of our silos. What's going to help us come out of our silos?
Yeah, not sure what to say, really. I mean, this is not about kind of turning everyone into a social worker or anything like that. No. But it's about helping everyone have the wider context and understanding the wider context in which they are working. They're all specialists in their own fields, and that's what they should always be. However, having an understanding that there is a wider context can help people understand when they might need to be able to advise and refer people on to another system, which can help. And also, there are some for whom actually having conversations with people in the wider system might prove helpful as well. But it's not about, it can't be about, you know, getting every practitioner to be responsible of every aspect of an individual or a community's life. It clearly isn't at all, but it's about having that wider view. And I think in terms of supporting practitioners in this, I mean, that is so complicated, isn't it? It's because some of it is also, it has to be about accepting your own limitations. On the one hand, you see the bigger picture of what is important. And on the other hand, we have to accept our limitations, the limitations of what we can do, and accept that, and hope that there are other systems, that there are other people, there are other professionals in place that can help, you know, with other parts of that person's life. Do you see what I mean? So I think it's being compassionate,
yes,
to ourselves,
yes,
taking care of ourselves, as well as encouraging self-compassion and self-acceptance in the people that we are working with,
yes,
as practitioners.
Yeah, and perhaps in my enthusiasm, I lost the message, which was the sense of us, when we come out of our silos, we practice an understanding of the circumstances of an individual, not just the thing that we're interested in. Not just the issue. It's the context in which this issue exists for this person. And for us to expand into that place. And that was, I suppose, what I was curious about is how do we support the culture or the shift that's taking place, and perhaps the shock that's going to happen now. We're seeing communities respond differently. And funny, I was talking to my friend and colleague Alistair Kent, who I've done work with in Surrey, and we're doing a lot of work with the family services in Surrey. And what struck me was, I wonder what's going to happen at the end of these 4, 6, 8 weeks when services haven't really been able to go in and support these families, and they're still coping. And will and will the services be able to step back and go, how did they do that without us?
I mean, I think at the end of this, there's going to be so many lessons to be learned if there's a preparedness to actually learn those lessons and possibly apply them. Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of it will come back to resilience and what is resilience about and how can we support that without pushing, you know?
It's making me think also maybe the parallel for connection. And from a client level, you're talking about behavior change both for themselves, but then also sort of reaching out and connecting to a broader community of people to both help themselves and help those people. But as practitioners and professionals, and we can even expand that lens in a much broader way for the current climate with COVID-19, where it's the healthcare community and the business community working together, and that the importance of connectivity is something that could be one of those enduring lessons of what we're all trying to cope with.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, this is not new stuff. None of it's new. you know, Health for All by the year 2000 and Healthy Cities and all the rest of it, they've been on the go, you know, pushed by the World Health Organization for donkey's years. And that's all about partnerships. How, you know, how do you make London a healthy city? It's about bringing together partnerships. It's, you know, at all levels, business, government, local communities. This all requires bigger planning. You know, sort of going back to that question of how do you help change an individual practitioner's perspective? Well, you can. I mean, I've been involved in education projects for years with health professionals, which have tried to look at that bigger picture and where they fit into that bigger picture. And it's been fascinating, really. For many of them, it's a shock because it requires letting go of power and turning their worldview on its head. But it's not unlike the shock that people have when they learn motivational interviewing for the first time, which is, I'm not the expert here. You know, this person is the expert. I need to trust them and I need to let go. And I need to stop diagnosing as well. So the same sort of messages apply to professionals when they're looking at their work in that wider context.
Hmm. Well, you know, the hour has simply flown by and there's still so much we could explore and consider and talk about, Jane. It's been fantastic to have you here. The thought that just struck me there as you finished there, it's almost like, how do we make compassion contagious?
Yeah.
And it sounds like what we have to do is we have to be carriers. And we have to bring it to other individuals. We can't just expect for it to happen for them. We have to be active in it. We have to be the activists. And for those people out there who are practicing, it's recognizing that it's the person next to you that you can be supporting change just by being yourself with them and valuing and validating who they are. And it doesn't have to be a client. It just has to be another person. And that human beings respond to connection. And they value being valued, they value being listened to, they value being heard, and that we can do that for everybody if we wish, and we can spread that just by being that. So on that very hopeful note, what we always do at this point in the podcast, Jane, is invite you to discuss or explore anything that's going on for yourself at the minute that may or may not be motivational interviewing centric, but just something that is interesting you at the minute that you would like to share with us.
I'll maybe throw this in because I thought about this when I was thinking about this podcast. I've been doing some family history in recent times and I've discovered a great-great-grandfather who at the end of the 19th century in the town of Leith, which is the port of Edinburgh, was in the town council. And I looked through the minutes of that town council and it was fascinating because every 2 weeks, there was a public health committee and a medical officer of health reported to the public health committee. And they were setting up all these amazing measures, most of them to do with contamination and control of infection, that are just basic public health, things we've sort of forgotten about the need for. So it was sanitation, it was access to toilets, it was quarantining ships coming in with disease, it was movement of animals, contamination of food, distance between houses, pavements, lighting, all of that were considered to be part of public health, which is what they are. The trouble is, towards the end of the 20th century, we developed a strong message, which was your health is your business. And the decisions you make about your health are just your business. And clearly that's not enough. And that's what's become so obvious with this terrible virus. We need to look bigger.
I imagine as a public health scientist exploring your family history there, it was an added bonus to find some public health relevance.
Yeah, it was fascinating. Yeah,
finding that information for sure. Wonderful. And another thing we ask our guests at the end of each episode is if you'd be willing for members of our audience to reach out to you with any comments or questions. And if you are willing, how can they contact you?
Yeah, I'm happy for people to get in touch. And my email address is janegrovestraining@btinternet.com.
Excellent. And we will put that into the episode notes as well.
Great.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome, Jane. It's fantastic. And so just as we draw to close, Seb, do you want to just remind people how they can also connect to us?
Absolutely. So Facebook, it's Talking to Change. On Twitter, it is at Change Talking. Instagram, it is Talking to Change Podcast. Email is podcast@glennhines.com.
Fantastic. From the question earlier on, that was from Maddie Nicholson. I just want to tag her, which is motivational mad, all one word, at motivationalmad. So thanks very much for that question, Maddie. Again, Jane, thank you very much for your time, your insight, and we wish you well and happiness and safety this time. To everyone else, thanks for listening, everybody. Cheers, Seb.
Thanks so much, everyone. Yep.
Thank
be
you.
Well. Be safe.
Take care.
Bye-bye.